Thanks, I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January the 5th, 1990. My home group is the early morning AA literature discussion group at NABA. We meet 7 days a week at 7:30 a.m. Please come by. And when I say that, I mean that I am a regular attendee there. I hope the food is really good tomorrow night at this rubbing elbow with the speaker's dinner, because I would hate to think anyone would go for rubbing elbows. You know, because the most important thing that I can be in Alcoholics Anonymous is a member of a home group. That was just beat into my head a long time ago. That really, almost really, nothing else matters if you don't have that. That is the fundamental unit of Alcoholics Anonymous. That, and when you say that you're a member of a home group, you know, do you ask yourself, you know, do I have a service position there? Do other people expect me to be there? Do I attend my home group's group conscience? Those are things that were just beaten into my head literally some 28, 27 years ago. Because my experience as an AA member, I only have two experiences really if I put them all down into two buckets. Because I came to AA in ninth grade when I was barely 14 years old. And so I have experience one, which is age 14 to 23, when I never really could gather together more than 90 days, if I was lucky, basically usually 40 or so. And then from age 23 to present day. And probably the most important message I have to anyone is that those experiences look very different, extremely different. And, you know, I am not a person who believes that anyone has to do what I do. I am, you know, I can only speak for myself and what others taught me and worked for me. But I'm aware of some very big differences between those two sides of that date on January the 5th of 1990. And some of that was my fault, because I never wanted to be a member. You know, you can attend AA or you can be a member. It's a big, huge difference. Sometimes I find that when I talk to new people now, it seems to be the hardest thing to transmit in today's Alcoholics Anonymous that with all the thousands of meetings that we have in almost every city and almost all around the world, it's so easy to just be a meeting attender. It's so easy to just grab a meeting when you can. And I travel for work 3 or 4 days a week every week. So I attend meetings. But I have been taught to never substitute that for having a home group. Now, listen, there's people who are new here tonight, and if I have any message to anyone who's new here tonight, if you don't listen to anything else I say, the only thing that I wish for you is that you find out soon whether you are or aren't an alcoholic. Everything else is probably none of my business. But if you don't know the answer to that question, my experience is that is the most important question that any alcoholic can find out for themselves. Do you suffer from this illness that's described in this book? I have a book in front of me just so that I can make sure I won't quote out of it or preach out of it, I promise. But it will remind me that we're here to talk about alcoholism, and we're here to talk about recovery from alcoholism out of the big book. Inside my big book, I have my other second favorite piece of AA literature, which is the AA group pamphlet. For me, that pamphlet should be sold inside. To me, I wish no big book was sold without one. I wish every single member would get that pamphlet to realize how important a home group is. But if you are new, I hope that you find out the answer to that question. If you've been around a while, then you can disagree with me all you want, and I'll respect your right to disagree. That's the beauty, I think, of, you know, you go through phases in Alcoholics Anonymous. If this was 1994, about a year after I met a couple of people, Joe and Charlie, and then Joe H. If this was 1994, you would have met a very different person. I would have told you that basically if you didn't come to my home group, you went to AA Light, and I felt sorry for you, and you were a member of Contemporary Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you wanted the message like the first 100 had, you would come to my home group, which was Alcoholics Only, and you would get the spiritual experience that the book talks about. Today, I am way past that phase. I still love the book as much as possible, but I also realize that how you transmit the message to newcomers and the compassion that you show dying people has a lot to do with whether they'll be willing to reach out and grab that life preserver. My experience is that if you are selling a program like AA with fear, it's not very receptive. That's just my experience. And if you're selling that program with fear, tapped off with your own anger about how everyone else is doing it wrong, it's just not effective. There's a man named Tom I, a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous in North Carolina, and he always stressed when talking about 12-step work that you have to separate activity from action. And the two are very different. You could have a lot of activity going on, but is there action going on inside the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And is it effective? Is it effective is the number one question for any of the work we do. So, you know, that being said, I'll tell you a little bit about my life. Like I said, I'm a garden variety alcoholic. What I mean by that is I've never been able to safely take one drink. It means that because I came in at a young age, I have run into a lot of people, especially as I get much older, that their story involves crossing a line somewhere. My story has no line in it. I've never seen the line. I don't know where the line is. It's never been visible to me. My story is just that what is described in the doctor's opinion and then better described and more about alcoholism is my story. That once I take one drink, my body does not physically know how to take care of alcohol the way normal people does. And it tells me I need to drink more. And it tells me I need to keep going. And then worse than that, the next day, regardless of the consequences of the month before or the year before or the last night, once I feel uncomfortable in my own skin, my brain, crazy brain, tells me, forget about the consequences. There's only one way for me to feel comfortable in my own skin, and that's to light the fuse again and to take the first drink. And, you know, because I didn't bother to find out what alcoholism was, I was a little confused. I mean, when you're 14 years old and you hear someone say the first drink gets you drunk, you feel sorry for them. I mean, you kind of shake your head like, wow, that is very unfortunate. Because drinking is kind of, I wear it like a badge of honor. Like, my drinking is what I'm known for. Like, I am that guy in the woods. I am the guy at the keg party. I am the guy at your parents' house when they go away on vacation and you have a party. Like, everybody knows that I'm the drinking guy. So I think by the time I was 17, I had established that it was the first shot after the eighth beer. Like, I had conceded to that to my innermost self. That if I just wouldn't do shots, I would be fine. I would have no problems. I couldn't comprehend. I didn't know enough about the disease. And the reason I talk about that a lot is, you know, our history books are great, and I saw all the books that are outside, and I'm a little bit of a history buff when it comes to I'm a history buff in general. So that just translates over to Alcoholics Anonymous. But inside our literature, unless you dig deep into AA Comes of Age, which what I would strongly recommend, is, you know, there's a common, and I'm not a speaker who has any Al-Anon jokes, right? I don't. Sometimes I say things that I think other people say sound funny, but, you know, my mother was a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups, and I am convinced that if she didn't do certain things when I was a teenager, I might not have made it here when I did. But, you know, if you watch the movies and don't read the books, which there's tons of AA movies out there, there is, you know, that one very famous scene. In fact, last week my wife and I were in Brooklyn, and I was with someone from AA who had never been to New York, so took him to Towns Hospital, took him to show where Bill had his spiritual experience, took him to Calvary Church, showed him where that is, headed over to St. John the Divine, where Bill's funeral was, and then into Brooklyn to 282 Clinton Street, where Bill and Lois lived. And if you've watched those movies, you know that at one point Bill is a couple of months sober, preaching his ass off, basically, from a spiritual hilltop, unlike the chapter Working with Others says not to do. There is a very famous part of that movie where he says to Lois, it's not working. And she gives the Pat Al-Anon answer, which is great for her. I concede. For Lois, the fact that Bill was not drinking was remarkable. Changed her life. But the fact that how he was carrying the message wasn't working, not good for somebody like me. Very bad for somebody like me, because until it started to work, the chain reaction that allowed all of us to sit in this room tonight would not have happened. And so one of the things that's lost in some of our history is before Bill goes to Akron, he sits down with Dr. Silkworth and he has a talk about what's been going on since he got out of Towns Hospital. And Dr. Silkworth asks him to tell him what he's been up to. And after Bill is done, Dr. Silkworth basically tells him his approach is all wrong. That you can't be out there preaching and throwing God in everybody's face. Like, you need to talk about the medical estimate of recovery. You need to talk about the physical disease of alcoholism. You need to get that person sitting across from you to concede that you have the same problem as them. You will be the first person that they sit across from that understands what it's like to be them. And, you know, today in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that I am, you know, probably dogmatic about, you know, I told you, if you met me in 1994, my message would have been a little bit different. I probably would have said something like, well, alcohol is only mentioned in the first step, right? That sounds nice in a meeting. If you're working the steps off a chart on the wall, and as Joe and Charlie would say, if you're working the steps off the wall, you have an off-the-wall program. They used to make it very clear. And when you judge alcohol is only mentioned in the first step, it makes me think, did you go through the big book with someone else who's been through the big book? Because if you do that, and let's just say, depending on, I'm very impressed they had a war edition of the book. That is absolutely the rarest edition, by the way. But if you go through that book with someone who's been through that book, you can start to ask yourself, I mean, that book is not a book of answers. It's a book of questions. It's a book of questions that let me find answers about myself. And for me, the kind of alcoholic that I am, and I know the big book talks about other things, but for me, when I look at the big book, and depending on the edition, you can argue the first 12 steps are usually in about the first 106 to 110 pages. Let's just say that from Bill's story or the doctor's opinion to working with others, 110 pages. Well, by simple math, the first step is talked about in at least over 40% of those first 110 pages. Really closer to 50%. Identification that you do suffer from alcoholism is criteria number one to get to steps 2 through 12. You have to know that you suffer from this. And I guess I never really understood why, but now I think I have a good understanding of why, and that is because those 12 things that hang on the wall are pretty drastic propositions for an alcoholic. In fact, if there was a 41st question or 42nd question, I probably could add two I've come up with over the last 28 years. I mean, I would probably add, are you able to form opinions without being armed with the facts? That seems to be a big trait with me and others I run into in this little club. And then the other question, I think that I would add, would be, when you drink, do you think you do crazy things and that makes you an alcoholic? Because so many people I run into, or so many meetings I go to, it seems that people describe their alcoholism by what they did or what happened to them, rather than what happened internally in their body that makes them mentally and physically different from their fellows. Bill W. gave a great talk to a bunch of religious people in the early 60s, and he really clarified the insanity he was talking about. He said, I'm not talking about people who do insane things while drinking. Everybody does insane things while drinking. We don't have the corner on that. I'm talking about alcoholics who know they're alcoholics, who are completely sober physically, and decide to take the first drink. The most insane thing any alcoholic can do. But I run into a lot of people who define how many bouncers they fought with or cars they crashed or God knows. I could go on and on and on with my own story. And truthfully, none of that makes me an alcoholic. It's kind of like the ism. You know, sometimes I'll run into a new person and I'll say, have you been to AA before? And you get varied answers, yes, no. And, you know, I like to ask them if they think they're an alcoholic. Like, what got you here? We all come here through different paths. And I love when they tell me, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And I like to ask them, why? Why do you think you're an alcoholic? And sometimes when I get an answer from some people, like, I have the ism. And I'll be like, well, that's nice. But, like, now, 28 years later, in my professional life, I run a pretty big company. And I have a lot of employees. And what I've found out is they all have some type of ism. Not particularly the kind that I have, although some of them do. But they all have problems. Lots of problems. What a lot of them, or most of them, do not have is a compulsion to keep drinking once they start drinking. And the next day when they're physically sober, their brain does not tell them to start drinking again. And it's that kind of information that I'm so grateful was presented to me, because my teenage years were a disaster, and that's really putting it mildly. I'm going through something at work, and I moved here 3 years ago, and I needed to get a license from the state of Georgia for my professional career. And I needed to get it within 90 days of taking the job. And I did what I normally do, which is, which I've been doing since I've been like 10 years old, is I took the test. I studied once, but I'll tell you my version of studying, because I reverted, I admit. I didn't learn how to study until I was 32 years old and 7 years sober, just so I'm honest. Like, I never took notes. I never used flashcards. I never did any of that stuff. At 32 years old, I had to humble myself, going back to college, to learn how to study. Because when I was like 11 years old, I got a question right on a test. And it was an extra credit question. And when the grades came back, the teacher asked to talk to me. And she said to me, I've been asking that question every year, and no one gets it right. How did you get it right? And I said, well, I remember like last October, you were in the front of the room, and you talked about this subject, and like on the right-hand side of the board, like halfway down on the chalkboard, you wrote this answer. I can see it. Now, I don't know if she told me that I had a photographic memory, but she mentioned that my memory was very good. And right around that time where I went to elementary school in New York, before you were going into junior high, you had to take standardized tests that every kid took. You had to have your number two pencil, which I couldn't even pull that off in sixth grade. How easy an instruction is, tomorrow, have two number two pencils. That is way too much for me to carry out, okay? That's way too authoritarian, way too rule-making. But anyway, I got called into meetings with my counselor and my mom. And I didn't really talk about this a lot because, you know, when you come into AA and you talk about all the things that make you cool. And you don't talk about the things that make you not cool. It's like rule in early sobriety. But my, you know, progress report is that over time, things are revealed to you and you realize the importance of them. And unfortunately, they're not cool. You know, they're kind of nerdy. But in that room with my mother and the counselor, what they basically said is that my classroom behavior did not match my scores. My scores were through the roof, and my classroom behavior was horrible. And because I had made a decision, I realized that teacher was on to something. The teacher discovered something for me that I hadn't discovered, which was, I don't need to do work. Like everyone else needs to do work. I just need to listen once or read, and then I take tests or I write papers. But I don't stay up to 4 o'clock in the morning studying. I don't tell my friends I can't go to the Saturday night keg party because we have a final on Monday. I don't do any of that. I just use my memory to not have to do work. And it's so funny that here I am, I read this book for the state of Georgia, and I go and I pass this test, and then 2 weeks later I get a letter in the mail from some lawyer who works for the state of Georgia saying there's good news and bad news. The good news is you passed your test. The bad news is there's some indiscrepancies with your fingerprints. And we need to talk to you, and you're going to need to come down. And so last night I happened to be looking at, I finally did get that license, thank God. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, if you're a blackout drinker, you know, that report they get from your fingerprints is very handy. If you don't remember a lot of your childhood or you did a lot of things in the woods like I did, you know, here I am, a blackout drinker, sitting in front of this woman who controls whether I get this license or not. And if she said no, I would have to go to this hearing board. And she has a nice report in front of her. And it tells her what day, where I was, what somebody else says I did, what eventually I admitted that I was willing to admit in court that I did, what a judge gave me for punishment, and the disposition of that case. But it's amazing that she asked me a question, and it was, what happened to you? This is why I kind of go crazy when I hear people say time doesn't matter. When I hear people throw that out like it's like one day in the door is something we refund and never ask you again that you won't get it. Because time does matter. Now, we all have bad days, bad weeks, bad years, bad decades. That's clear. And when we hand out chips, we don't have a scorecard in front of us. We don't call people up and say, Johnny, celebrating 11 years tonight. Let's go through the checklist. All good with the IRS? Work going well? Not late anymore? We don't do that. We just give you a chip, tell you to say your 2 minutes. But if you're a real alcoholic and you're given the mercy of one day's sobriety, and there's only three groups of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's group one that I don't identify with. They come here right away and they never leave. I don't get them. I don't understand them. But I meet a lot of them. And there's group number two, a lot like me. In and out, in and out, in and out. And then finally, something happened and I'm here for a while. But the third group is bigger than the first two groups combined. And that's the people who've been here who never came back. Because when you refund your sobriety, I will welcome any newcomer back. I just won't guarantee them that they might come back the next time. That's how precious sobriety is. And for me as a teenager, you know, I didn't show up. Accelerated math is kind of a demarcation line for me in seventh grade that I can clearly remember. I didn't want to go to accelerated math. I didn't want to go to accelerated science. But I got a sign there. And when I showed up at Accelerated Math, this was my first year at junior high, and I'm at a school now that's four elementary schools altogether. It's not just the kids I went to elementary school with. And, you know, I was not dressed like this. I was dressed in what I would call my uniform of the day, which was black engineer boots, Levi dungarees or corduroys, some kind of heavy metal concert shirt. If it was the winter, a white thermal shirt under that concert shirt. I had a Levi dungaree jacket with an Ozzy Osbourne oil painting on the back of it. And in the winter, I had a three-quarter length army olive drab jacket that had a Who Quadrophenia symbol painted on the back of it. That would be how I would show up for school with a pack of Marlboro Reds stuck down the front of my pants. That's how I showed up at Accelerated Math. Now, I don't know who's been in Accelerated Math, but when you look around, there weren't a lot of people like me in that room. The people I hung out with in the woods were not in that classroom. There were a lot of other people in that classroom who had a lot of different skills than I had. Like, by the third day of school, they had the perfect notebook with the perfect dividers, with the perfect folders, all labeled, right? They took notes in class. They did their homework every day. They never got detention. I mean, just, and I feel like I've been trying to get back in Accelerated Math now for like 40 years, right? Like, that's like the moral of my story. Is I've been trying to get back into Accelerated Math. And I come from a horribly dysfunctional family, and I say that because I don't want any new person to think that that has anything to do with me being an alcoholic. It has absolutely zero to do with me being an alcoholic. And sometimes I think that's unpopular to say in Alcoholics Anonymous today, that we live in a world where we want to blame external things for an internal condition. We want to blame it on grief, we want to blame it on trauma, we want to blame it on family, we want to blame it on something. And all those things are horrible. And I'm the first to admit, my family caused a lot of my problems, just not alcoholism. Almost every other problem in my life I inherited from how I was raised to live. But not the one that has me behind the podium tonight. The one that has me behind the podium tonight has been with me since I was born. Because I'm mentally and physically different from my fellows. And, you know, I was speaking somewhere and they were handing out a trigger sheet, which I found very interesting. I don't know if you've seen one of these, but I found it very interesting because it was a sheet that they give to people leaving treatment, telling them what not to do. And I completely agree that if you don't have a foundation in the steps, in a home group, with a sponsor, then I'm the first person to say, stay away from people, places, and things. But just staying away from people, places, and things is not going to keep you sober. Just like hearing me speak is not going to keep you sober. I can't get drunk watching other people drink. I can't get sober listening to other people talk about getting sober. Those are very, very separate things. And you know, for me as a young kid, I'm very honest about my first drink. I don't know what it is. That's my honesty. And I'm honest about where I come from. Number one, a lot of things don't count as drinking in my family. So I have to get that out, right? Like, first of all, not all drinking counts as drinking in my family, right? So this is a pretty good common keg cup, actually, if you're familiar with the outside keg party. Just holding one of them in my hand is not really drinking where I was raised. Drinking implies a mission. Drinking implies that you have no idea where the night brings you, but that's what drinking is. And worse than that, my family doesn't believe in alcoholism. Now, through generations of recovery, and Al-Anon and AA and other 12-step fellowships, we've had to succumb that there is such thing as alcoholism, but I was raised believing there is no such thing. And, you know, going to a Yankee game with my dad or a Jets game, taking a sip of a Schaefer beer is not really drinking. It's in the father-son handbook. It's how we bond. It's okay. When I talk about drinking with an ING, I'm talking about my first night with the older guys in the woods. I'm talking about being in the woods and getting my first 8-pack of the old Miller Pony bottles and then getting my second 8-pack. Like, that's my first night of drinking. And when people talk about progression, which again, for me, is a scary word, because people progress positive, negatively, sober, or drunk. That has nothing to do with you suffering from alcoholism. For me, suffering from alcoholism is like being pregnant. You're alcoholic or you're not. If we're talking about progressing down the toilet bowl of life by the places I landed and the people I hung out with, then yes, I have progression. No doubt about it. But I'm as alcoholic today as I was when I was born, as I was that night in the woods. Now, progression for me as a teenager around alcohol is very simple. By the time I was in ninth grade, the only thing I taught about on a Monday morning in homeroom was, where are we drinking Friday night? And who has fake ID? Who has money to get beer? Whose parents are away? The whole list you run through. But by the time I was in 10th grade, the only thing I thought about on a Monday morning was, I can't make it to Wednesday night like everybody else, like to Friday night. Like, Friday night might as well be 2 years away. Like, I need to drink by Thursday, preferably Wednesday. Tuesday would be acceptable. Like, I need to drink soon. Like, I can't make it to Friday night. And, you know, I think about that. And, you know, if you're new, there's certain things that we laugh about in here that other people in the outside world don't laugh about. There's certain things we cry about in here that they don't cry about, and vice versa. I mean, obviously, my teenage years were plagued with alcoholism. My dad was an undercover narcotics agent. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was the toughest guy I ever met. And, you know, a historic figure in the law enforcement community where I come from. You know, I can still Google today some of the big, you know, he always called himself a BC narc, a before crack narc. You know, I can still Google some of the heroin busts that he made back in the day of, like, major, major weight. You know, and my dad was kind of a strange guy, you know. At one point, he was a homicide detective, and then at another point, all of a sudden, he would come home in leisure suits, or a New York telephone van, or a Corvette, or a Long Island lighting truck. Like, he was a deep cover narcotics agent, and he was violent as all get out. And he had his own view of the rules of the world. I'm not saying they were good, many of them were not, but he just had his view of the world. And how, if I was going to spend time with him, I was going to spend time with him when he was drinking, because that's what he liked to do. He liked to arrest drug dealers, play softball, and drink. Which seems like a pretty good life to me, right? I mean, it seems, it looks attractive. And when you go a place with a guy like that, and everybody is intimidated by him, good guys, bad guys, everybody, you want to be just like him. And he drank. And, you know, by the time I was 12 years old, 13 years old, my dad did not let me get hammered in bars. I would never say he did. But by the time I was 12 years old, I knew that an upside-down shot glass meant my dad had a drink coming. I knew that my dad put money on the bar and the bartender made change. He didn't put his money back in his pocket. I knew how to what points on it. You know, my dad would bring me the bookie card during football season, the thin white card where you circled the numbers so that I could make my own bets. I knew what points on a game meant. I knew how to play every game of pool. I knew how to play every game of darts. I knew about the bar living. I knew that there was like this outside world of light and this inside horrible world of the bar life. And for me, that looked way more attractive. I was definitely drawn to it like a magnet. And, you know, I would remember going to work with my dad to cash his paycheck back in the good old days. So I never remember my dad ever going to a bank. Like, I've tried. Did Dad ever go to a bank? I don't remember it. I know that if I didn't have school and I was home every other Thursday and he was working nights, we would go to his law enforcement office because we would go to this place in New York and we would go into this building across the street from the law enforcement building, and we would go downstairs where there was a tunnel that went across the street so that the undercovers wouldn't go in the law enforcement door. And I know he would get his paycheck, and then we would leave, and we would go to bar to bar to bar. And he would cash his check right at the bar. He would take his check out, sign it. The bartender would know him and take it and cash his check, take his tab out. Like, that was financial training in my family. That's banking 101 in my family. But my parents soon got divorced, and I hated my mom for that, even though I'll fast forward a little for you, because I can't take anyone here through the 12 steps in an hour at the podium. The good news is, though, it's possible. You just need to invest the time. It can only be done at a kitchen table, in a park, before a meeting, in a backyard, in a diner, one-on-one. But as a teenager, my alcoholism progressed quickly. And I am not the sit-at-home, like I've heard these people tell their stories in AA. I'm so jealous of them. They like to come home and get hammered and get up and go to work the next day. That is absolutely not my story. I like to come home and I like to wake up around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I like to hope that there's at least one cigarette, preferably two, left on my nightstand. I like to light that cigarette, and I like to get a cup of coffee or an iced tea as soon as possible because my throat is killing me. And I want to get to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts and get a new pack of cigarettes and a coffee or an iced tea. But then within an hour and a half, I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. And even if I got bailed out that morning, my brain tells me the only way I can feel good is if I have one drink. And as long as I don't have the first shot after the eighth beer, I'll be fine. It just never worked out that way. And like I said, when I say I was proud of my drinking, I can't underestimate that. Like, sickening proud. Like, I liked being a 10th grader more than a senior. Because when you're a senior, all the older kids are away at school. But when you're a 10th grader, you go to a lot of parties with the juniors and the seniors. And I like nothing more than to sit down in someone's parents' kitchen and to take a quarter in my hand and to bounce it off a kitchen table into a shot glass until 4 in the morning and make some senior who's like the center on the football team, who's like 40 pounds heavier than me and 6 inches taller than me, puke his guts out. And I wear my drinking like a badge of honor, like I wear my fighting. And fighting and drinking is, and a bad temper are obviously horrible combinations. You know, it's a recipe for coming to the attention of a lot of authorities. So for me, what happened is I had a PINS petition filed against me, which in New York is a person in need of supervision. And my school district filed one on me, which meant I needed to go to family court, juvenile court. And I went there with my mother. And I don't have a piece of paper in front of me, but let's just say at that family court, I don't know who else here is around my age, but I'm a TV kid of the 70s, right? I graduated high school in the 80s. So I grew up with the Wednesday after school special, with the bulimic mom, the drug addict dad, the alcoholic brother. It seemed every after-school special was about some tragedy in the family. And here I was in this courtroom with a judge and a social worker and a prosecutor and my mom, and we had to prepare a contract. And that contract would get put on a magnet on the refrigerator at home. And the contract was things like, Billy's going to go to school. Billy's going to do his homework. Billy's not going to smoke at home or school or in between. Billy's going to put the garbage pails out and take the garbage pails in. He's going to be home at a certain time. And then Billy's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, in my family, again, completely not the poster child for mental sanity or health, right? Not in that business. My dad was infuriated by the going to Alcoholics Anonymous, because in my family we have a plan for our males, especially males that look like they might not want to go to college. So that's an Irish Catholic, closed-minded male, like myself. And so the plan is, you take the New York City Police Department test. That's the plan. And so I took the New York City Police Department test when I was 16 and a half years old. That was a cutoff. I think I was like 2 months older than that. I took the New York City Police Department test. I got a 98. But again, let me explain what happened. I don't know how it is in Georgia, but in New York, they print a book. It's blue and white for the police department. You study it. They have a couple of practice exams in the back. And then you show up at a high school in Brooklyn, and you take this test, which is what I did. Within a year, because in New York, adults in the criminal justice system are 17, not 18. Within a year of getting that grade in the mail, I would never be a New York City police officer, ever, based on my fingerprints. It just would never happen. So my family goes to Plan B, which is the New York City Fire Department. They have less requirements, except you get a red book that's red and white, and you study that book, and you take those practice tests. When I was 18, I got 100 on the New York City Fire Department test, on the written. By the time I was 19, I would never become a New York City fireman, ever, based on my background. And, you know, it's funny because I have so much interaction in the last, especially 15 to 20 years of my professional life with non-AA people. And they look at life so differently to us. You know, if I say to them that my driving license privileges in the state of New York were suspended before I ever had a driver's license, they're in shock. They will actually say things like, "You drove before you had a license?" Whereas in here, we would question you if you waited until you got a license, right? We would be like, "Are you sure you're an alcoholic? Like, you waited?" But I started getting into lots of trouble. And when I was 17 years old, I went to my first DWI school, which was interesting, because you're a 17-year-old kid at Farmingdale State College on Saturday mornings with a bunch of 30, 40, and 50-year-olds, right when DWI was becoming the in thing to enforce. And, you know, if you're new, what I would tell you is, if you need legal advice, there's a couple of bad places to get it. DWI school, people who sit next to you in the probation office, the bar you hang out in, and Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, those are horrible places to get medical or life training or any kind of advice about, like, you go to a lawyer. But I remember some of the things I learned there, and I think about them now, and they're insane. Like, I didn't even know what a white wine spritzer was when I was 17 years old. I didn't even know what it was. The only thing I had drank by that time is lots of beer, lots of peppermint schnapps, lots of tequila, lots of old granddad, lots of wild turkey, lots of southern comfort, and all the garbage stuff that we drink. But I never heard of a white wine spritzer. I don't even think Bartles and James was invented yet. It was like 2 years after that. But this guy told me, you should, maybe when you're going out and you're driving, you should switch to white wine spritzers. And, you know, all I can tell you about that, and I am the person who does not, I do not at all make light of drunk driving, which I'll get to. But what I can tell you is what I found out is I can drink like 40 white wine spritzers, right? Like, that's what I found out that night. Like, that's a good idea. And then I met another guy, and he told me that I didn't prepare to drink right, which I had never heard that either. Nobody ever told me that there was this preparing to drink. And so he said, yeah, he said, you know, you got to make sure you eat just enough, but not too much. And then you got to put a big glass of water on your nightstand for when you come home. And you need to put like 2 Tylenol or bare aspirin there. And that way when you come home, you take those Tylenol or bare aspirin and you drink that water and you're not dehydrated and your headache goes away. And, you know, what I can tell you is, you know, like, although I tried it like 50 times, the result was always the same, which would be that I would wake up the next day. There would be like empty White Castle boxes on my nightstand. A tall boy or two from 7-Eleven that I got on the way home as a traveler. The water is spilt. I don't know where the Tylenol is. But I say that because of how much I love more about alcoholism in that chapter. When faced with a decision of you cannot drink at all, or you can try this thing that works for other people. You can go with this big glass of water. You can put the Tylenol out. You can eat right. I'm going to go with that. You know, the book is very clear. Are you willing to say, accept spiritual aid? Or do you want to blot out the past? And for me, that's an easy answer when I was 17, 18 years old. Spiritual aid, that seems a little bit too extreme for my problem. And, you know, in my high school yearbook, I went to my high school 20th reunion for a lot of reasons. One, because I did not go to my 15th. I did not go to my 10th. I went to my 5th. I got thrown out for fighting in cocktail hour. So I went to my 5th. But my 10th and 15th, I was too ashamed of things I had done to go back and face that crowd. I say that honestly. And I was years sober. At my 20th high school reunion, I blew right by the valet stand to the back corner of the parking lot and basically just looked at myself in the mirror and said, you know, can I really walk in there? Do I really have what it takes to stand up? And it's funny because by this time, email and the internet had been invented, right? So you register online for the reunion and they have this hokey biography page that you fill out. And, you know, by that time, I had gotten my life in order. I'd went back to school. I had a decent job. And I would get these cryptic emails from people, like basically trying to say, what the hell happened to you? Like, how is that possible? And that high school yearbook that they had on display that night on the table, there's 2 predictions about there in me, about me, in the I predict in 20 years section. There's one that says St. John Hospital will dedicate a wing to Billy N. And the other says Billy N will have broken every bone and torn every muscle and ligament in his body. Now, at 17 or 18 years old, as a senior, I thought that meant I was cool. I thought that meant I was a good kid to go to a party with in the neighboring town if their football team was going to be there. I thought that meant if you were going to get into a fight at the roller rink after the roller rink outside, that I was a good guy to go with you. Today, what I know what that means is I stand here today, I have no left kidney. I have no spleen. I ruptured both of them. I've had my ribs kicked in so many times by steel-tipped boots because I have this ridiculous physical problem, which is I'm a blackout drinker, so I don't pass out. And basically what that means is by about 3 o'clock in the morning, I lose control of about every muscle in my body except for my mouth. Like, that seems to work better, unfortunately. And that comes with a lot of penalties. That comes with lying outside the back door of an Irish bar and someone kicking you in the stomach and I can't shut my mouth. Like, I'm going to get the last word in. And I bring up being cool because if you're new, I just want to share some of my early sobriety before I even got sober this time. Is I had somebody say to me outside a meeting, Billy, you're a pretty nice kid, but unfortunately you might be too cool to get sober. And that's a shame. Now, I didn't know what that meant at the time. I had no idea. Today, I am visibly probably upset to the naked eye if I am in a room with a guy, especially a young guy, who's too cool to be sober. Because when you've been too cool to be sober, you can recognize it from across a room at 500 feet. Because it's a horrible place to be. Because I finally had to learn that cool people don't get sober. It just doesn't happen. You know, I want to be the guy who's late to every meeting. And I not only want to be late, I want to be loud when I'm late. And I want to pass by and sit by my friends and high five and whatever else, shake hands, and then I want to get up a million times, go to the bathroom and get coffee. And this is pre-pager, not even pre-cell phone. This is pre-pager. Imagine how distracted I would have been today. But I was too cool to get sober. And I always tell the story of, you know, the meeting after the meeting. Because, again, I go back to time doesn't matter. I like to throw out time doesn't matter when I'm in my favorite diner with my 10 friends who we don't have a year total if you added up our time and multiplied by 10. But I'm going to tell you that time doesn't matter. And I'm also going to tell you that you're an AA lunatic. That you're an AA revivalist. Because I'm going to sit, because I'm a judger and I'm a bully. So I'm going to sit at the other table and I'm going to point at people. Because I'm never going to be like them. That sounds worse than jail. That my whole pathetic life is going to be Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it. This is the big ticket. This is all I get. Just wasn't going to happen. And when I went to my first anniversary meeting, when I was 16 years old, I just gave in. I've been in that AA for 2 years. And I heard people talk about big Friday night anniversary meeting, last Friday night of the month. Everybody was talking about it like they were going to like a Metallica concert. So I was like, I'm going to go. I'm going to go to the big Friday night anniversary meeting. And I remember sitting there. And I remember it like it was yesterday. Typical basement in a church. Typical window that's cut between the meeting room and the kitchen. Somebody handed a sheet cake across. An old lady, like maybe 35 years old, turned the lights down halfway. And then a guy came out, a really old guy, with a sheet cake with candles on it. And all these people started singing happy birthday. And I remember like thinking to myself, like I was 16, like 26, 36, 46, 56, like this is it. If I make it 40 more years, last Friday night of the month. And I had, you know, there's a story in the big book in the fourth edition where a woman talks about, her story is awesome, but the one line that I love in there is that she says, most people change their drinking to meet their goals. And she changed her goals to make her drinking. That's my story. That is one hell of a powerful sentence she put together to describe me without saying anything else. Because I had not been to a Yankee Red Sox game without my dad yet. I had not been to an Islander Rangers game at Madison Square Garden without adult supervision. I had not been to a Jets tailgate. I had not been to an outdoor heavy metal music festival yet. Like, I had these things I wanted to do. You know, people sometimes say, you know, if you're new and you haven't read the big book or you don't have a sponsor, I just plead with you to get a sponsor and go through the big book. Because there are things you can hear in AA that aren't in our literature. They apply to some people, but not all of us. The great thing about our literature is it's the great equalizer. We all can identify with it. Because I've heard a lot of people say, there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. That's not my story. I've been in tons of bars with people I met in AA. Some of my favorite people to drink with when I was a teenager. I love to drink and talk about the losers in AA. Once I start drinking, I never think about AA. My story is there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and your mom's head full of Al-Anon. That's my story. my mom started doing certain things. And there's another little saying that you hear in rooms, that my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. That is absolutely not my story. Not even remotely close. I think it comes from the page in the big book that says, I wouldn't trade the life today for the life of yesteryear. That's a totally different question. There's no way I would trade my life today for the life of yesteryear. But don't ask me to tell you that checking into a maximum custody penitentiary at 5 months sober was better than spring break Fort Lauderdale 1986. Okay? Because I am very clear about which day was better in my life. Extremely clear. And I'm going to fast forward to just tell you a couple of things as I close here. Because so much of my AA life has to do with who I made fun of and who I judged and who I never wanted to become ever. Some AA lunatic. Somebody whose whole life they acknowledge depends on this fellowship. I never wanted to be that person. And I had a horrific car accident where someone was killed and I had to serve time and I lost my driving privileges for many, many years. And I'm very grateful for the couple of years sober I had when I was released. And I don't put that sobriety time down either. There was a time, like I said, in 1994 when I would have came to this podium and I would have told you that all of you were trying to kill me, that you were hiding the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you were giving me solutionless alcoholics, and I had a whole repertoire to say to you in my fanatical days. The fact is, if you had a big book in your hand, I would never talk to you, okay? The fact is, if you went to Big Book or Traditions meetings, you would be the last person I would make friends with in Alcoholics Anonymous. But let me just tell you what happened when I was 3 years sober. I had a really good sponsor. And the only thing I was really committed to was my home group and sober softball. I was really committed to sober softball. Now today, based on my own behavior, I don't even think those two words should ever be used together, right? But that's just based on, I've discovered that I am a really, really bad loser and a worse winner. But I've discovered that in sobriety, so it's made life easier to accept. But there were two things my sponsor told me I had to do, besides everything else. He had two special requirements. The first requirement was that I go to the Bill W. dance. That I would have to save like $4 a week and give it to him. And just a little newcomer math, $4 a week to me is two packs, by that time, Newports. That's what that was. That was gold to me. $4 might as well have been $40,000. But to my sponsor, it was a deal breaker. I would give him $4 a week. He would buy my ticket to the Bill W. dinner. He would give me the money back to go rent the tux. And I would go back and be grateful for the New York Intergroup and the phones being answered and the people who kept Alcoholics Anonymous open for when I got here. That was a deal breaker for him. So I did it. The next thing he told me I had to do was in the spring of 1993, I had to go to this thing called the Joe and Charlie workshop. And so I had no idea what that was. Zero. But again, I had to give him a couple of dollars a week to save up for the registration. So that was at the New York Marriott Marquis. And if for those of you that went to Joe and Charlie workshops, you know they started on Friday night, a couple hours, all day Saturday, half day Sunday. And so I showed up. And guess who was there? Everybody I hated in AA. You know, every single person, like when you're new, you kind of go to meetings every night. You know how it is to be new. You're on the rotation. You know where you go, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Well, at every meeting I went to, there were people I hated. And those people I hated were the people at the table in the diner whose whole pathetic life was Alcoholics Anonymous. And so here I walk into a hotel, and everybody I hate from every meeting is there. And worse than that, like, they have notebooks and dictionaries and like special big book dictionaries, and the real lunatics have like a 1939 dictionary, so they knew what the definitions were when Bill wrote it. And what I can tell you is that weekend saved my life. It's a miracle. There's lots of other miracles that have happened to me. But that weekend, I mean, I remember when Joe came over to me at the end of the weekend, I was one of the youngest people there, and he told me to turn to the chapter to the wives. He told me to cross out wives and write mothers. He told me for the next month I should read that every day, and every place it referenced a wife, I should write mother, and every place it referenced a husband, I should write son. And I should read that so that it's got into my head what it was like to live with me as a parent. Like, I learned that weekend that I suffer from the disease I started this talking about. Like, I finally realized what is alcoholism. It's not that I had a rough childhood. It's not that I had grief. It's not that I had shame. I had all of that. But even me perfectly with none of that, I have a major defect in my body and my brain. I suffer from this thing called alcoholism. You know, and that was a miracle to me, and I am so grateful for that today. Last weekend, I was in Oklahoma, and it's so interesting that I was doing a workshop in Oklahoma, and in the front row was Joe's wife, you know, and that's the second time I've ran into her in a couple of years now. And, you know, the ability to go up and say to her, you know, I really want to thank you for what your husband gave me. I know he wasn't perfect. I'm not putting him on a pedestal. I'm just thankful that he was able to transmit what's in that book to me in a way that I was able to digest and understand. And the other miracle I'll just share about is, you know, when I was in that correctional facility, you know, I don't judge people as far as, I get very mad when I hear people give theories about what it's like to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in a correctional facility. I hear people say, oh, they're just there to smoke, they're just there to get cookies, they're just there. What they are doing is that's a gathering of members, the highest rank in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a member in a correctional facility in the Inside Freedom Group, and I was transferred to minimum security. And by this time, you know, I'll just admit to you, psychiatrically, I have some difficulties. And one of those difficulties would show its symptoms in is that I do better in maximum custody holding than I do in minimum. I'm just a better maximum I'm cut out from maximum custody better. I'm better with one or two other cellmates in a small cell that opens up into a small day area for like 20 of us, and I'm allowed to go into the yard, you know, a couple hours once or twice a week. I am not good in a room like this that has 50 bunk beds with 50 guys like me where I have to tie my sneakers to my cot so I can hear if somebody's trying to steal them in the middle of the night. Like, my temperament was not meant for that. But the one benefit of minimum security was where we met to have meetings, first of all, I was allowed to have a Walkman. I was allowed to have a Walkman that didn't have AM/FM, only cassette, so I'm really dating myself. If I want to really date myself, I'll tell you that Hammer Time was the big song of the day at that time, right? So just so you have an idea of how far back it is. But in our meeting room, we had a small cardboard box, and we had speaker tapes, the old cassette tapes. And I was allowed to sign one out and bring it back to my bed. And I signed the first one out, and I hated the speaker because he said something stupid like sobriety time in jail doesn't count, which for anyone that's lived inside that kind of human zoo, trying to live by spiritual principles in there is not an easy task. And getting drunk is easy any day of the week, almost easier than outside. So I had this resentment, but when I brought the tape back, I decided for whatever reason to take another tape. And that tape on the top of it said, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And I brought that tape back to my cot, and I listened to that tape. And I listened to a man who killed two people drinking and driving when he was 23 years old, who at the time of making that tape was about 30 years sober, and the warden of a maximum custody correctional facility, the first convicted felon in the U.S. to become the warden of a maximum custody penitentiary. And boy, did that tape give me the hope I needed. And I ran on that hope. And then I met Joe and Charlie. And I've had the privilege of belonging to great home groups and having great sponsors and serving in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had the privilege of being the chair of AA World Services and a trustee on the General Service Board. I've traveled to Russia and the Czech Republic and Ireland, all to carry AA's message. I'm married today. My work life is awesome. I'm the moderate one in my family today. I was the disaster. Today, I'm like the reasonable older brother. I talk to all of my siblings. It's very interesting that when I went to my dad's funeral, I was the only one talking to all my siblings, and two out of the four weren't even talking to my dad. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle. And when I think about AA, I always think about two things in particular, because I think it's very easy. Peg M is one of my favorite speakers in the world. If you've never heard her, it's worth listening to her. And one of the things she used to always talk about is that for an alcoholic, we just have bad brains. I mean, I like to drive home and start to think that I don't get to ride my motorcycle enough, and I don't get to do this enough, and I don't get to do that enough. And unfortunately, because of the brain I have, it immediately deducts that I need to cut something out of my life. And unfortunately worse, because of the brain I have, the first thing my brain tells me to do is to cut back on AA. Especially since Tom I told me that he's had a lot of problems in life, but cutting back on AA has never been a solution to one of them. Not one. And, so I think about that, and I leave you with these two things because it's what I remind myself of. Number one, that in 1998, Time magazine decided that they were going to write a new book in celebration of the year 2000. It would be called The 80 Days That Changed the World. And in 1998, Time magazine gathered together a committee of the most honored and distinguished history professors in the world. Not AA people, not AA archives people, just the smartest historians. And they said, your assignment for the next 6 months is to get us a list between January the 1st of 1900 and today. What are the 80 most important days? And when that list was published, I have that book at home. You can get it sometimes on eBay. It's called The 80 Days That Changed the World. When you go 13 stories into the 20th century, you land on Mother's Day 1935, where it says, on this day, a broken stockbroker from New York met a broken surgeon from Akron. And from that formed the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has saved millions of lives of alcoholics. And not only that, has shared their solution with others. Like, I have to ask myself constantly, am I treating AA like it's one of the 80 most important days of the 20th century? Am I really treating it like that? And then I have to think about 2012, when the Library of Congress decided to publish a new list. They decided to publish a list, the 88 books that have had the greatest effect on the United States of America. That list is in alphabetical order, so you only have to go to number 2, where you find Alcoholics Anonymous, published by Works Publishing in April of 1939. That's what our book is considered. And the last story I'll tell you is that the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had the privilege of serving on the board level and doing some things, but at the end of the day, this fellowship is about front lines, working with alcoholics and carrying the message. Now, we can only do that if we support our central offices and our districts and our general service office, because their job is to facilitate 12-step work. And people sometimes ask me, well, how do we know that our money is really working? How do we know that the seventh tradition really works? And so I just leave you with this story because it's one that I know from the positions that I've held, and take this home, and it's the last thing I'll say, is that in 1993, a young man named Jay from North Carolina was a Marine in the United States Marine Corps and got sent to a place called Beirut, particularly the Beirut Airport in the country called Lebanon. In June of 1983, Jay was having a rough time, and he wrote the General Service Office through the military mail and let them know that he really needed literature. He had no AA literature with him. And so they mailed him literature and sent him a letter, and in July of 83, he wrote back, and he thanked them for that literature, and he told them to please send more if they could, so they did. And in August of 83, that young man wrote back to the General Service Office, and he actually used some of Bill W.'s language. He said, "I have good news to report." He said, "I've started the Peacekeepers Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in between the shelling and the bombing and the shooting, we gather together with some locals and some of the service people, and we have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." But he then said, "We need more literature. Get us more literature." So they wrote him back and sent him more literature. And then they hadn't heard from Jay in about 3 months, and in December of 83, they got a letter from another member from that group who said they had the heartbreaking job of letting the lady at the General Service Office know that the young Marine they had been writing to had been killed in the barracks blast of the end of October 1983 when 274 Marines were killed. And so that young AA member, that young Marine, was killed that day. But the person wanted the person at the General Service Office to know that the group was still going. And I tell you that story because if you were to Google Lebanon A Alcoholics Anonymous today when you leave here, you would see that on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday nights at 8:30 p.m., there is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The meeting that was started because a young Marine had no literature. The meeting that was started because AA groups put a couple extra dollars in the basket. And when that lady got the letter, there was money to send a big book. And the fact of the matter is, if you haven't heard it, 80%. First of all, we have veterans suffering from alcoholism entering AA at a rate that's unprecedented since the Second World War, even bigger than returning from Vietnam because of what's gone on. I don't care politically how you feel. For us, the fact is veterans are returning or coming to Alcoholics Anonymous at a rate never seen before since the Second World War. And when we put a couple of dollars in the basket, we should think about that money that's being used to get the message out. Because the truth is that 80% of the countries in the world that have Alcoholics Anonymous, you can trace back to their member number one, their Bill or Bob, was a United States or Canadian sailor or soldier who was there on military duty, who brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to that country. So when people talk to me about AA politics and all this other BS and dollars, I just tell them about Jay. Like, Jay was just dying, sitting in an airport in a really bad place, suffering from alcoholism, and he wrote asking for a book. And because it was a couple extra dollars, somebody sent him a book. And because of that, Alcoholics Anonymous meets three nights a week still today in Lebanon. So I'm very grateful to be here. I look forward to the rest of the weekend. Thank you.